Stars shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me.
Better than we were last week. We hope all of you have recovered from any illnesses that you may have picked up over the holidays. Holidays are fun, but it's always good to recover from them. Our so-called government caved in again to the corporocrats. The HNIC signed over a bit more of our future so that the rich can keep on getting richer. The rest of us just keep on trying to get by. Another year's worth of locking people up without even the semblance of legal proceedings. Some more drone attacks on women and children the world over. Continued erosion of freedom. Business as usual in D.C. and the other bastions of world government. And so it goes. I first heard that term, the HNIC, in some movie. Morgan Freeman played a school principal. I don't remember the name of the movie. You know, it's one of those titillating phrases, one that somebody like me of Caucasian descent isn't supposed to think or say. So naturally, I'm going to translate it right for you right now, right here on the New American Dream Radio Show, because I absolutely delight in being politically incorrect. HNIC stands for Head Nigger in Charge. And, well, you know, we got one of those. I mean, that's what we actually have in this country. But before that, we had a head honky in charge, He was just as bad. The racial part is pretty ridiculous. Totally superfluous. Racial epithets, well, any kind of group epithets, they're pretty superfluous. The blacks, the whites, the men, the women, the Christians, the anti-Christians, the Jews and the Gentiles, the Islamists and the infidels, every group you can think of, every group you could make up, they've all produced spectacularly horrible examples of humanity. No one group has a monopoly on stupidity, prejudice, or immorality. You can find it anywhere, and you will find it everywhere. Although maybe, just maybe, there's one race that's worse than all of them, all the others. I'm referring, of course, to the human race. Animals are ever so much nicer. They may be cruel, but it's generally for an obvious and logical reason. They don't hatch plots. They don't pretend to be or do one thing and when they're actually doing and being something else, just the opposite. They tend to love or hate unconditionally. They don't judge others. It would certainly be refreshing if we were to take some lessons from the animals. I have a dream that someday, somehow, we will all manage to live together in peace, free of violence and hate and war. And I keep on dreaming this dream, and we keep on telling you about it here on this show. And now, as I often do, I'm going to play a little something from Bill Hicks.
It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and we're glad you decided to tune into our show tonight. I'm proud to turn it over now to my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests Sherwood Ross in Coral Gables, Florida, and sister Megan Rice, who will be speaking to us from Washington, D.C. So tonight we are gathering together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Coral Gables, Washington, D.C., Duluth, and wherever you are. Megan Rice, sister Megan Rice, is a member of the Transform Now Plowshares, the three are Michael Wally, W-A-L-L-I, Megan Rice, and Greg Borchi. They succeeded in a disarmament action at the Oak Ridge, Tennessee Y-12 nuclear facility before dawn on July 28, 2012. They hammered on the cornerstone of the newly built, highly enriched uranium manufacturing facility, splashed human blood, and left four spray-painted tags on the recent construction, which read, "Woe to the empire of blood, the fruit of justice is peace. Work for peace, not for war, and plowshares, please, Isaiah." Under the cover of darkness, they intermittently passed beyond four fences in a walk for over 2 hours through the fatal force zone. "We feel it was a miracle. We were led directly to where we wanted to go," said Greg. After navigating through the complex, they came to a long, white, windowless building marked HEUMF. "It was built like a fortress," Greg Borchi said, describing the four guard towers. Unimpeded by security, they attached two banners to pillars of the building. "Transform Now Plowshares," read the first, with a green and black icon showing part bomb, part flower. A second stated, "Swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, Isaiah." In addition, between the pillars, they strung red crime tape. "We're still opposing this filthy, rotten system, Michael," Wally said. "Jesus has no nukes in heaven and no torture in heaven." Okay, then. "The signs of revolution. Revolution will not be televised," they say. "Is this the revolution? From where will it come, if it comes? The Plowshares action in Tennessee may be a great letter to the editor. A recent article says that violence has risen in Chicago due to increased poverty. Maybe that is where the revolution will begin. Maybe it has already begun. 100,000 marched down the street in Washington, D.C. Some old guy refuses to stand for the national anthem at a Red Sox-Yankees game. A lone man drags his grandfather's hunting rifle to the mountains of Idaho. My guess is that probably it comes from poverty and necessity and maybe some reading, learning, but where would the learning come from? Corporate TV, probably the internet. Some spark, some fire that just happens that was not quite planned but just seemed to work just right. Or probably it never happens. Well, not until it would get very bad and very evident. Lots of us are advocating investigation into U.S. history. I think that's pretty important. There's a lot to think about and do. An editorial comment from myself. The Second Amendment, deer hunters say the government can't take away our guns because we will fight. So they need assault weapons for when that big day ever comes. When, for 30-plus years, this has already taken place for a generation by Americans, nonviolently, revolt, fighting against U.S. militarism and spending our resources on weapons of mass destruction rather than schools, healthcare, children, families, jobs, homes, all the good stuff, because there is no money left over from our spending on bad stuff, military and its weapons. Shock and awe. These Plowshares movement folks gathered a couple years ago to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the first Plowshares at the General Electric plant at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, when 8 people sneaked in and pounded on cruise missile parts with hammers and were arrested and served time, and since then there have been dozens and dozens of like protests. But we hear nothing about them because our media is like TASS, is Vestia. And we do not live in a democracy. We have a rich history, but it's only covered in somestat, only to be found by chasing after a loose piece of paper in the parking lot of Walmart, or on the back of a liquor store receipt in Pine Ridge, or on the cardboard sign of a homeless woman in Seattle. The truth is out there, it is here, it exists, but the information is not to be found in your local paper, on your television, or on your radio. It's just not. And yet it does exist. It is important for our sanity to know that somewhere there is something rock solid, something that is real. Everything is not fog and mist and unknowing and uncertainty and vagueness and black helicopters here, men in black over there, chemtrails up there. Something is solid. There is bedrock to be found. Dig? To find the truth about America, don't listen to regular radio or watch TV or read what you feel you're expected to read. That's never going to work. Don't watch the news on TV. Read Time and Newsweek every week. Read the full New York Times every day. That's never going to work. What you need to do is to chase down those loose pieces of paper blowing across the Walmart parking lot. I found this, I think it was blowing across the parking lot, or it was on maybe my old Christmas wrapping paper. It appeared on the internet on Christmas Eve. I think there was a star above it and 3 guys in black suits and sunglasses riding donkeys following it from a distance so as not to be seen. This is dated December 24, 2012, 9:32. It's person says, I don't believe that Abraham Lincoln gave a damn about black people and their status, nor do I believe that he did not deliberately provoke the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter. I don't believe that the Spanish blew up USS Maine and Havana Harbor. I don't believe that the Lusitania was not carrying munitions intended to kill Germans. I don't believe that warmonger and consummate moral slug Woodrow Wilson involved the U.S. in World War I to make the world safe for democracy. I don't believe that the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was a surprise, nor do I believe that it was unprovoked. I don't believe that Hitler exterminated 6 million Jews in gas chambers. I don't believe that Harry Truman dropped atomic bombs on defenseless Japanese civilians as a military necessity to save American lives. I don't believe that General George Patton died from injuries received in a car accident. I don't believe that the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in the 50s was any kind of a communist threat to the U.S. I don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President John F. Kennedy. I don't believe that the Vietnamese attacked the USS Maddox in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964. I don't believe that the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in 1967 was an accident. I don't believe that James Earl Ray assassinated Martin Luther King. I don't believe that Sirhan Sirhan assassinated Robert F. Kennedy. I don't believe that Saddam Hussein was not deliberately provoked into invading Kuwait. Nor do I believe that George H.W. Bush, by and through his agent April Glaspie, did not deceive him into thinking the U.S. didn't care whether he invaded Kuwait in response to the said provocations. I don't believe that Clinton wanted a peaceful solution with the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia over the Kosovo issue. I don't believe that TWA Flight 800 exploded in midair because of a spark in a fuel tank. I don't believe Saddam Hussein tried to buy yellow cake, uranium oxide from Niger. I don't believe that Saddam Hussein had reconstituted any WMD programs when Dick Cheney said he did. I don't believe anything that Colin Powell said about Iraq in his speech to the UN. I don't believe that Arabs attacked the U.S. on 9/11/2001, in part because the U.S. government has never produced any evidence in support of its story. I don't believe that Osama bin Laden would pull off such a daring and successful attack and then deny it. Therefore, I don't think Osama bin Laden had anything to do with it. I don't believe that the Three Towers collapsed due to fire. I don't believe that Bruce Ivins was the anthrax killer. I don't believe that any of the numerous post-9/11 U.S. wars of aggression against any Arab Islamic countries have any justifiable legal, moral, or practical basis. I don't believe that Pat Tillman was killed by a friendly fire accident any more than I believe that General Patton died from injuries due to a car accident. I don't believe Obama has a legitimate U.S. birth certificate, because if he did, he would produce it. Thus, I don't believe he is even a legal U.S. citizen, let alone a natural-born citizen of the U.S. I don't believe that Obama wanted to repudiate the Second Amendment and disarm the U.S. citizenry because they care about the children, because if that were true, they wouldn't be senselessly murdering children in faraway places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen on an almost daily basis, nor would they be arming and supporting a bloodthirsty, illegitimate rogue state Israel, which brutally and routinely kills defenseless Arab children, apparently for sporting purposes. In summary, I don't believe anything the U.S. government, its owners, agents, and neighbors, apologists, and court historians say about anything of any significance. This is from the lowly comment section of an alternative website, not the New York Times. Well, there is a place like no place on earth, a land full of wonder, mystery, and danger. Some say to survive it, you need to be mad as a hatter. And if you come to understand this mad place, the others will tell you that you are entirely bonkers. But I'll tell you a secret. All the best people are. Back to you, Chuck.
And now, please join us for another episode of Beltway Sandy Snore, Big Time Journalism Horror. When we last left Sandy, he just received, as he sat with a friend at the Bulldog Bistro in downtown D.C., a subpoena to appear at the next session of the House Un-American Activities Commission. He read the formal paper silently, Well, is prime rib cool to the taste of prime tuna? The committee will be reconvening next week to investigate un-American activities such as the murder of children in Iraq and Afghanistan and the restricting of personal freedoms in the United States through the so-called Patriot Act, as well as the infiltration of American organizations by members of certain domestic clandestine terror groups. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Central Intelligence Agency? Sandy smiled wanly at his companion, folded the paper neatly, placed it into his inside jacket pocket. He made a comment about the dessert and ordered a strong Bordeaux. The next day, Sandy began to stoically prepare for the end. The stupid provincial song that had played on the car radio kept repeating in his head. If you had but one day to live, dude, what would you do? What would you do, dude? He found the paper on thick vanilla stock tossed onto his desk. He unfolded it, read it again, set it down, looked at himself in the mirror as if for the last time, and took a cab. He stared out his window at the activity, now wishing he'd done more, loved more, gotten more involved with people. He would miss them, it seemed.
In the so-called green room, Sandy sat on a plush chair with the others, the chairs pushed back against the wall, in almost a perfect circle, one chair absent, like a missing tooth, Sandy noted. Sandy knew many of those in the other chairs, sitting with their hands on their knees and their heads down. Some were famous, some not so much. One by one, the other journalists left the room when called. They were told to bring with them whatever they had brought. And they did not return, Sandy noted. At the end, it was just Sandy Van Snore and a woman from National Public Radio he had talked to one time at a party for the senator from South Carolina. What's his name? He smiled at her and she nodded back. Their eyes told all that needed to be said about the lost chance at the cocktail party for that one senator, about the gallows steps they were both about to climb. She held out her hand and he gripped it, then wiped his hand down his pants as subtly as he could manage. A woman from NPR, who he did not quite get her name into his memory, was called.
Sandy ran through the alphabet in his head, trying to get at least her first name. Well, then he remembered, what the heck, she's gone. They're all gone. He looked around the room and heard his name. Mr. Van Snore? Mr. Van Snore! He looked at the young woman in the door, rose and followed her into the bright light as the condemned behind the sad hooded priest. The big, bright room was busy, bustling with young men and women holding papers, hurrying back and forth like worker ants with bits of leaf and sticks in their mouths. Someone touched Sandy by the tip of his elbow, and by that slight pressure was able to direct him wherever he needed to go, around tables, feet, canes, to a seat in the front row facing the HUAC. Then he folded his hands atop the table. He could only hope he appeared sane, innocent. He found his bearings. Without turning his head, he sighted up and down and around at the journalist kneeling and seated, aiming cameras at him, at the microphones up and down his long table, at the committee members across from him talking over their shoulders, accepting pieces of paper from young people, at the empty chair right in front of him. Someone, somewhere, pounded a gavel and the room began to quiet. More pounding. And the noise gradually subsided like the waves in the big wave pool at 5 o'clock. A man to the side of the empty chair pulled the microphone toward himself. He looked right at Sandy, as if Sandy were the only one in the room, the most important. And Sandy wondered if he might be a psychiatrist. He'd make a good one. The man told Sandy that the chairwoman of the committee had wished very much to be here today, but on her way here this morning from her home state, her small plane crashed in a forest. There were no survivors, the man said. Sandy gasped. His mouth dropped open. He looked around the room and saw that everyone was busy doing something else and being very quiet about it. He was the last to know. He looked back at the man who appeared to have taken over as head of the committee. Sandy drew a deep breath as he prepared for the coming grilling, the questions, the admonitions from the remaining committee members up and down the line. One woman in a green suit, three to the left at the empty chair, dragged her microphone over the wood, sending a squeak over the room, over the international airwaves. Mr. Van Snore, you are, her words echoed and squeaked, and Sandy stared at her and saw himself shuffling off the prison steps, wearing an orange jumpsuit, hands cupped at his waist. A flock of pigeons stirred for a moment and sat back down as Sandy's and escorts passed on their way to the cold steel penitentiary front door. You are the most entertaining media guest on the late night talk shows. I have to say, we just love it, my family and I. And what I have to ask is, do you write those top 10 lists yourself? Sandy answered the question as best he could, then another from another committee member about being an Ivy League football star. Did he ever wish he'd gone to the NFL rather than into journalism? A short congressman from a southwest state down the line asked Sandy if he tried to match his ties to any particular season or event. Then they were out of time. On his way out, congressman from Idaho asked Sandy how he got those front row seats at the Nationals games. I see you on TV, the congressman said, as he was whisked away by a young staff member to another meeting.
Sandy stood alone in front of the big stone building. He turned to face the street. He waved the cab on and walked toward a place he knew. He sat at the bar looking up at the TV. He sat and stared and sipped. He watched the news, wondering about the committee chairwoman, about what had happened to the others in the green room. He watched until the news turned into the lead-in music for a Survivor Borneo, and swiveled around, put his elbows on the bar, and looked around to search for anyone he knew. Join us next week for another episode of Sandy Van Snore, Big Time Journalism Whore, when we find Sandy lost in bumper-to-bumper beltway traffic, late for an appointment, and having to pee pretty bad.
Mike, we seem to have Megan ready here for her interview, and Sherwood has not joined us yet, so I think we need to swap the interview, so I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce Megan now.
Okay, I will do that. I'll just have to scroll down here just a bit. Megan, Sister Megan Rice is a member of the Transform Now Plowshares who went to a nuclear facility in Tennessee. Megan, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mike.
How are you?
Just fine, and thank you for inviting me into your program.
Nice to talk to you. Could you tell me a little, maybe a short bio about yourself, please?
Well, I've been living for a good 82 years. It started in 1930, and I had two wonderful parents and two older sisters who nurtured me into the reality of the Depression, a Depression baby. So I'm feeling very much at home right now in times of depression, recognizing this perhaps similar root causes. Expenditures on military appropriations instead of on people and friendship around the world. So I'm a sister of the Holy Child Jesus, religious order since 1950, and I'm still very well and able to carry on our mission of helping others to find God in this wonderful creation, this planet that we share.
You've been involved in some other protests at Fort Benning, and I think you served 6 months in prison for that. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, and many of us have done it more than 1 6-month time, and I was happy to be able to do that a second time because the first time didn't seem to work or affect the change that we were calling for.
Where did you serve your time for that?
The first time was in Danbury, Connecticut, a minimum security prison for women, where there is also a huge maximum security on the same facility. And the second time I spent 5 weeks in Muskogee County Jail in Columbus, Georgia, which is a good experience, a good way of getting an insight into local jails. And then I went for the rest of the 6 month time, which was like four months and three weeks, I guess, to make up at Danbury. So only those two places.
So on the morning of July 28th of this past year, you, Michael and Greg went to Oak Ridge. Could you tell us a little bit about that morning?
Well, we knew, we have been knowing for a number of years that the government had been planning, instead of reducing and disarming our stocks of nuclear weapons, which have been truly monstrous over the decades, reaching to probably 40,000 or 50,000 having been made, they say 60,000, but down to maybe 10,000 now, we don't know, maybe 5,000 on alert. And these facilities, three of them, were going to be enlarged. So we felt that a message needed to be given to the public, which is very misinformed about the nuclear industry as it continues as one of the largest expenditures in the military budget and in the budget of the country. So we felt that we needed to bring that message of truth to the people who have been working for many, many years at Oak Ridge Nuclear Facility in Tennessee, the Y-12 facility it's called. Since 1943, it's been in existence. And it was having a brand new plutonium higher enrichment facility be built, and at the cost of probably many, many billions of dollars. The total allocation could be ending up $600 billion by the time they finish the expansion that they plan to do in modernizing and refurbishing instead of eliminating and transforming the whole industry into that which is sustainable and creating projects that really are needed and therefore will stimulate new, not only new jobs, but a new and vital and much more diverse economy for, you know, for this country and for the world, really. So we got in there in the early morning. We felt we needed to carry the message, and we didn't want to be stopped because we knew it was our obligation to oppose crimes that we know are being committed by, unfortunately, by our government, and has not been spoken about and has been kept very secret these 70 years. Workers not even knowing what their partner workers are doing to that extent. So we were able to get there, and we climbed two hills and down two hills through the forest, and we were able to enter through the outer perimeter fence with ease and pass on in at about 4:30 in the morning, perhaps it was by then, but plenty of light because it's highly lit. And we were able to get in and bring our message of truth and a message of friendship and love that we have for each of those people who are having to work there in making nuclear bombs in order to put the breakfast on their table for their families. And we really pitied them, and as we do all workers in the nuclear business. We needed to inform them of the truth of the illegality of this project. And what it has done in the past, we brought sacred symbols to speak very starkly about that, the symbols of blood, because of all the blood that has been shed, has been wasted on the victims, more than 200, probably 100,000 in Nagasaki and Hiroshima back in 1945, and an ongoing devastation of cancer cases, not only in all over Japan, but around the world since the nuclear industry began exploding nuclear weapons for testing as well as for use that first time and only time, and may it be the only time. So we brought that message to those workers, and we were able to succeed in labeling the building. We didn't actually know where we were, but it turned out to be the very spot where we should be, the warehouse that stores not a few tons of highly enriched uranium, but more than 400 and can still being added to as we speak. We labeled
were you,
it.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, we labeled it with signs. We had spray paint, and it was a white painted cement block building, very simple looking, and we were able to say what was really going on and what couldn't happen as long as this was in existence. Peace and happiness could not take place because there was no justice, and the illegality of the materials that are there against the divine law and the divine method of harmony in our planet and our universe.
You went through some territory in that walk that morning that was a kill zone, I think. Were you afraid to do that?
Well, we felt that it was so important, and it is so important to get this message around that we must not continue. We must transform this 70-year-old industry of death into that which it promotes and enhances life. And so if we were to die for that message, I think it's a worthwhile to give one's life for such a message of truth.
And so you spent probably some time in county jail before arraignment, or how did that all work out?
Well, we were there until probably from about 4:30 in the morning until they decided what they were going to do with us after being handcuffed and asked to sit with our hands cuffed at their backs and sit on the ground, which was not very comfortable, until finally after 4 or 5 hours We did bring out three chairs for the last 3 minutes, for the last maybe 20 minutes. And in the meantime, they had gotten their orders, I suppose, to bring us to jail. So we were taken, the three of us together in one car, to the county jail there in Maryville, Tennessee, Blount County jail, and stayed there through the next week. And one of us decided that he couldn't accept conditions of release unless the judge would accept to state the illegality of nuclear weapons. When the judge said that he couldn't do that, he chose not to do it, then Greg said, well, then I choose not to take your conditions of release that you're offering. And so he stayed another 45 days because of that message.
And now what are you facing now? Have you been through trial yet, or are you still going through trial?
They have postponed the trial three times. First, I think it was going to be in October, and then they shifted it to February, and now it shifted to the 7th of May. I guess the lawyers or the prosecutors are wanting to see how they can design, the arguments to say that we are saboteurs and that we have given damage to government property.
And how many? What charges are you facing, and how much potential time are you facing?
Well, I think now the latest charge is one of sabotage, and I think it's on two counts, and the other two felonies. The sabotage is a felony, and the other two that they're going to try to prove that we destroyed or damaged government property. And so that probably if you added it all up, it would be about 35 years.
How are you handling this time between now and court? How are you preparing to face whatever might be upcoming?
Well, we have always been trying to live a community lives of peacemakers wherever we are, whether always trying to work for peace and harmony and spreading love. And so we continue to live that way and continue to try to design ways in which people will listen, people will be invited to listen, and that the truth will be exposed, the real truth of what is being sabotaged. We spend time reflecting, we chime in prayer together and discerning, and we have no fears that whatever is going to happen. We feel that we have been doing exactly what was our obligation as citizens of this country and of this world, as stated in the United States Constitution. We are obeying principles that have been expressed as laws and treaties internationally, perhaps going back earlier than even World War II, the end of World War II, when they established the Nuremberg Principles, which had to do with the behavior of many people in Germany who accepted to obey unjust laws. And because they didn't refuse to obey unjust laws, they were punished in jail and sometimes punished like losing their lives, I think. Yes?
Megan, we'll have to close it up, but I want to thank you very much for taking the time and also for your witness, and good luck in the future and what the court case brings.
Yes, and thank you very much for helping us to get this message out by use of your media.
You bet. Thank you very much, and have a good night.
Yes, and blessings on you all through the year as you become peacemakers. Thank you.
And now it's time for another episode of The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog. We've heard all about the Russian space monkeys who went into outer space and didn't come back until the Soviet Union was gone. And then when they did come back, they were expecting maybe a parade or a nice DACA out on Tiger View Lane, but that didn't happen. Well, the Americans had their own space dog program going, trying to match the Russians with similar results. When those dogs returned from having been sent up by President John F. Kennedy and then splashing down after November 22, 1963, the world they returned to was barely recognizable with Lyndon Johnson in the White House. Some of those dogs took the option of shooting right back out to space. Some moved to Ukiah. Some lived on the streets for years and years. Some raced to dig up some money buried in the backyard and moved to Edina. One of those was Buzz. When we last left Buzz, he had just received a certified letter and delivered by an unnamed new mail person packing Pomeranian spray. Buzz pinned the envelope to the floor with his paws and ripped it open. It was from one of his old space pals, Neil, the space poodle. A real lapdog's lapdog, Neil was. Uh-oh, he sniffed the letter closely. The letter was supposed to have been delivered days ago. Neil would be here today. Oh, crap, thought Buzz. And he pooped on the carpet and sniffed it. Neil was a big shot. He had actually been to the moon. Buzz was only a test dog. This Earth orbit stuff. They didn't have the technology then. Computers were as big as whole rooms then. The radiation belt getting buyer machine, all that came much later. Buzz hurried around, dusting, straightening, making the house look presentable. He pulled out all his slick moon photos and his moon rocks and set them on the kitchen table along with an excellent Eau de Toilette 1969 Apollo 11. Buzz sat in the chair with his nose looking out the front window. A long black limousine pulled up right up to Buzz's front walk.
The driver opened the door and out walked Neil, the stately poodle, still with so much style and class and pizzazz. When the bell rang, Buzz was right there, but he willed himself to wait. 1001, 1002, then he nosed open the door. Buzz took Neil's hat, collar, whistle, and muzzle, gave him the tour, and they hopped up to the kitchen table to settle in. Buzz poured the toilet water into the bowls, pushed over the kibble with his nose. They talked about cats and birds and people and balls for a while and sticks. So Buzz said, I've been meaning to ask you. He put one foot up on the table to drag the photos over closer. These moon pictures. He could sense that Neil was already getting tense. His ears were pointy. His fur was bristling. They almost looked like they were done in a studio, at least to me. That lunar lander thingy, there's no dust underneath it. Wouldn't there be? Buzz nosed the moon rock over where they could both see it up close. And how do we know this is a real moon rock? Not just something, Buzz pointed with his nose toward the backyard. I've seen lots of these out there. I mean, how do we, Neil growled, showed his fangs. He stood, curled his tail between his legs. Buzz pushed the rock closer, got the other photo in his teeth that Neil was supposed to have taken of the other dog with the perfect reflection in the face shield. That seemed kind of improbable. Tossed it down in front of Neil and Neil nipped him. Neil bit Buzz right on the paw and hopped down with his nose in the air, trotted over to stand in front of the front door. The driver opened it. Neil pranced down to the limo and stood by the back door until his driver came and opened it.
Buzz stood in the open doorway and watched them leave. Buzz saw himself, just a reflection, in the darkened windows of the limousine as they pulled away.
Stay tuned next week for another adventure of Buzz the Space Dog, when we'll see Buzz ask himself yet again, "What was that?" Thinking he might have heard something, and then admonishing himself, "Nobody else heard it. Must be going crazy. Maybe it's Spiegelheimer's. Wonder where I put that dog ear conversion chart that came in the Alpo bag." Our second guest tonight, Sherwood Ross, the regular columnist on our show, and we're glad to welcome him back. He's been a speechwriter and press aide to Mayor Richard Daley in Chicago. He's worked as a reporter for the Chicago Daily News, got radio media experience at WAAF in Chicago and WOL in Washington. And, oh, he's just been around on so many things. Columnist Drew Pearson called him an unsung hero for one of an expose he did on WOL. And so I'm going to give him a call right now.
Chuck.
Hello, Sherwood. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and Happy New Year to you and to all your listeners around the country and the world.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, Sherwood. Please go ahead with your column.
Yeah, well, you know, as an avid internet browser, I just can't help but notice all the anti-Semitic comments on the web. I go to a university campus every day, and I don't see this among the young people. They seem to get on splendidly with each other, whatever their race or faith. But I still read a lot of attacks against the Jews on the internet. And it's made me think about how often Jews still get blamed for things. And it's not just in America. Of course, it's true in Europe. And it wasn't just in Germany. You can't blame Hitler for all the destruction of the Jews. I mean, other countries, France and Russia, had a lot of anti-Semitism. In fact, as Hitler's war machine was banging on the gates of Moscow in November 1941, there was panic in the Russian capital. Many public officials fled. They were shipping their children to the East. And it was common for ordinary Muscovites to blame the Jews for the coming fall of the city, when they all believed the city was going to fall. But when Moscow was saved, the Jew-hating Muscovites gave none of the credit to the Jews who helped defend the city. And, you know, that's so typical. One of the characteristics of the anti-Semite is that when things go wrong, the Jew, as if there's only one, the Jew is held responsible. But when things go right, no credit is given to any Jew who played a role. The anti-Semite doesn't get the whole picture, not because he is necessarily stupid, you know, but because he does not want to get the whole picture. The Russian poet Yevgeny Evtushenko knew all about anti-Semitism in Russia. He wrote, "There is no Jewish blood in my veins, but I am hated with a scabby hatred by the anti-Semites like a Jew, and therefore I am a true Russian." Well, I can't say whether anti-Semitism to any great degree still exists in Russia today, but I can tell you this disease is alive and kicking on the internet. I've read on American websites outlandish stuff about Jewish bankers who wanted the recession, about Jews in government who were responsible for President George Bush's attack on Iraq. Even worse, about Jews who were dancing with joy on 9/11 when the World Trade Center was coming down and thousands of people were dying. Take this story of the so-called dancing rabbis on 9/11. A group arrested in New Jersey who watched the World Trade Center burning and were said to be dancing and rejoicing. Allegedly, the story goes, they were arrested by the police and then released. And, you know, even if this tale were true, those who repeat it never mention the millions of American Jews who wept at what they saw that day on their television screens, or Jews who lived in New York and saw firsthand the World Trade Center's coming down. And that's because the anti-Semit only points to the rotten apples in the battle, in the barrel, rather. And they generalize that what's true of one bad apple is true of all apples. You know, they'll point to Bernie Madoff and reason from his crimes that all Jewish stock traders are swindlers. In fact, when anti-Semitism grips a society, Jews really don't have to do anything wrong. They get murdered simply because they're Jews. In the First World War, many Jews who fought for Germany won medals, and the Kaiser praised them affectionately as my boys. Yet when Hitler came to power, these same heroes were arrested along with all the other Jews and murdered in the concentration camps. As far as Hitler was concerned, all Jews were alike. Human beings, Jews included, have been compared to snowflakes in that no two of us are said to be alike. So those who blamed the Jew, like those in the recent past in America who blamed the Negro, are stereotyping millions of people when they assume all Jews are all Negroes and the like. Anti-Semites even believe that all Jews think alike. For example, that all Jews are Zionists who support Israel, or that all Jews care only about money. You know, readers write in condemning the Israeli Jews for wanting to drag America into war against Iran, so as to knock out Israel's principal rival for domination in the Middle East. Yet one recent poll showed that 60% of Israeli Jews don't want a war with Iran. They don't want to attack a war with Iran. Just as many Americans opposed attacking Iraq in 2003. So it might be fair to say that Prime Minister Netanyahu wants to attack Iran, but he hardly represents all Israeli Jews. There is also a belief among some people that anti-Semites are a bunch of uneducated and dangerous fools. You know, but this is stereotyping too. Some anti-Semites are highly intelligent, literate individuals, such as the great American poet T.S. Eliot. Of course, that doesn't make their charges against Jews true or correct. What it does show is that they haven't thought the issue through, or that they know the truth, but that they prefer to have that old, comfortable feeling that comes when they can look down on another group, such as Jews, as being inferior to themselves. In one of his poems, Burbank with a Baedeker, Eliot writes of the Rialto business district in ancient Rome, in ancient Venice, declaring, "The rats are underneath the piles, the Jew is underneath the lot." And in another poem, Geronchon, Eliot says the owner of his decayed house is a Jew, who was spawned in some estaminet of Antwerp, and estaminet being another name for a brewery. Now, of course, this is just absurd on the face of us, on the face of it. Which brings me to another characteristic of an anti-Semitic libel. It can't be proven. It's ridiculous on the face of it, maybe even crazy. T.S. Eliot may be saying the Jew is underneath the lot, but that's only a cheap generality. Eliot can't mean that Jews are lower than rats and crawling around under them, can he? So what does he mean? What he means is to smear Jews generally as low characters. What evidence does he present for this? None, of course. His first charge that Jews are born in beer halls, that's another silly libel. I doubt that Eliot ever met a Jew or any other person, for that matter, who was actually born in a beer hall. Of course, there was a very famous Jew who was born in a lowly manger, but Eliot doesn't attack him for that in his poetry. So all of this brings me around to my own poem on T.S. Eliot and the Jews. I suppose by now it's hardly news. T.S. Eliot despised the Jews, not one or some in words ephemeral, but with a capital J for Jews in general. Referring to Jews in ancient Venice, T.S. found them quite the menace. The rats are underneath the pile. The Jew is underneath the lot, T.S. claimed in his false argot. Worse, the Jew is not a woman born, but spawned in some Antwerp brewery, which the sly, sneaky Eliot implies is the breeding ground of world Jewry. While demeaning Jews is out for furs and money, the hypocritical old crank neglected to tell his readers he spent a lifetime working in a bank. So in conclusion, I'd like to say it's easy to blame others, including whole groups of people, Jews, banksters, Africans, and blaming them unjustly. But we have to be careful. The sloppy thinking of T.S. Eliot and many others in Europe in 1920 who were prejudiced against Jews created an atmosphere in which Hitler could persecute Jews without fear of contradiction, and by the time Europe and America woke up to what Hitler was about, it was too late. Tonight, before I go to bed, I'll read some of T.S. Eliot's poetry. My favorites are Murder in the Cathedral and The Wasteland. Just because Eliot was a prejudiced bigot doesn't mean he did not write a lot of wonderful poetry that made good sense. You see, T.S. Eliot wasn't all this or all that. I don't condemn him out of hand because he wrote a dozen stupid anti-Semitic lines. I'd rather remember some of his better lines, like these from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown till human voices wake us and we drown. I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Thank you, Sherwood, and have a good night.
Thank you, Chuck.
And now it's time for Let's Ask Mr. Science. Dear Mr. Science, when you are sitting in your big chair in your Mr. Science TV show office, do you ever just lean back and wonder about stuff? Like, do the different M&Ms really taste different, or is that just our minds making that up? Like, why do we have never been back to the moon? Why don't we have electric cars, wind-powered, solar-powered houses, more of them everywhere? Why John Kerry and Al Gore gave up so quickly when it was so obvious Bush stole the elections of 2000 and 2004?
Why candidates like Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul get immediately lampooned and canceled by the major media? Why NPR used to be good and now it's not? Why the major media all say the same thing, that you know certain things will never be said in public, and they might even be wrong, but we never get to figure that out because certain things never are even talked about. Timothy McVeigh seemed to have this calm about him, went to his death seemingly so easily. Why are there so many lone nut terrorists? It's almost like there's a real MK Ultra, and they kind of like manufacture all these things in order to scare us. Ever wonder about that, Mr. Science? About Fukushima. Where'd all that radiation go, anyway? Why did the sky seem bluer as a child? Why do your son and daughter have to sign up for the military and learn to kill, even if you don't or they don't want to? Why do you have no choice whatsoever but to pay for weapons in the military, even if you don't want to? Why certain things happen, like wars, and nobody asks you? You call your congressman. There's no doubt left in your mind that you're a nobody. Your opinion is not sought out or wanted or even warranted. Chemtrails. Global warming. Huh, Mr. Science?
And Mr. Science, do you ever sit in your car at the red light on the way home from your national television big TV show and wonder, why, Mr. Science, why? About Flight 93, let's roll, all that jazz?
About how there are bumper stickers in movies that say, let's roll. Tell them about how Todd Beamer and all them saved the day and then died in the big movie plane crash. And yet there were no body parts. No plane parts. We did not dig 24/7 with all available machinery to try to rescue anybody who might still be alive. Well, maybe, Mr. Science, Mr. Television Personality Man, maybe there was no crash there. Maybe, Mr. Science. Is that your real name? If Todd Beamer and the others, crew and passengers, died that day, maybe it was not in a plane crash. Perhaps, probably, killed by their own government, by the CIA, part of the horrible plan carried out by the U.S. government and the Israeli Mossad, as the real evidence suggests, on September 11, 2001. The day and events that still dominate our world to this day. And yet, it never happened. Did it, Mr. Big Shot Science Guy? At least not like that. Maybe Beamer and the others were heroes. Maybe they fought the CIA bravely before they died. Maybe. But the CIA agents in the editor's office and TV news offices will never let us know. That movie will never be made. Won't be on Ask Mr. Science at 4 o'clock every weekday during the school year, will it? Mr. Science? Hello? Mr. Science? Hello? Mr. Science?
And now we bring you the New American Dream big commercial sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, the NBA, U.S. Army, Google, Nike, CNN, and lots of other people who bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV and radio and in the newspapers to millions of people, and nobody gets fired or killed. Jim Fetzer. The evidence that none of the official plane crashes actually took place is simply overwhelming. Not only did Flight 77 not hit the Pentagon, but Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville. And even though we have all seen videos supposing to show Flight 11 hit the North Tower and Flight 175 hit the South, we know that those videos are faked or fabricated one way or another. As Pilots for 9/11 Truth has shown, Flight 93 was in the air on 9/11. It was over Champaign-Urbana after it was supposedly crashed in Shanksville. And Flight 175 was also in the air, but was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh long after it had supposedly effortlessly entered the South Tower. Indeed, FAA registration records show that the planes corresponding to those flights were not deregistered or formally taken out of service until September 28, 2005, which means that none of the official plane crashes actually took place. It has been astonishing to me to discover that the atrocities of 9/11 were not simply allowed to happen, but come closer to having been produced as a Hollywood-style spectacle, with phantom flights, faked phone calls, and fabricated crash sites. Anyone who wants to continue in a state of naive belief in their government as a nurturing institution that is dedicated to the best interests of the American people and promoting their welfare should read no further, because 9/11 appears to have been a national security event that was approved at the highest levels of the Bush-Cheney administration, including the CIA, the Pentagon, the NSA, and the White House itself. When consideration is given to the totality of the evidence, no alternative explanation is reasonable. Jim Fetzer.
This has been the New American Dream Big Commercial, sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, the NBA, Google, Nike, CNN, the National Football League, and lots of other people who bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV and radio and in the newspaper to millions of people, and nobody gets fired or killed.
For decades, centuries, America and the world has been protected by those strong enough, smart enough to hear the voice of honor calling to their hearts, those brave warriors to whom we owe our freedom. Who can forget Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Eugene Debs, George McGovern, Peter Moore, and Amon Hennessy, Lucy Parsons, Big Bill Haywood? And today we salute those who continue to answer the call.
The few, the proud, the women from Code Pink. Food Not Bombs, a global force for good. Be all you can be. Join We Are Change or your local 9/11 truth group today. Aim high with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. An army of one or two or three at 4 a.m. underwater through the swamp with a hammer in their teeth over the fence, through the fence. Into the building to hammer on the United States military killing machines and destroy them. The Plowshares Movement, defending freedom and humanity since September 9, 1980. We're looking for a few good women in black. Be part of the action. The world can't wait. Veterans for Peace. It's not just a job, it's an adventure. Peace is our profession. Join the Occupy Movement. They're strong, and there's Catholic workers strong. Semper Fi. Hoorah.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. On Sunday, Dick, his wife Jane, and the fam strolled down their walk wearing Hunter's orange suit, dress, and dress-up New Year's blaze orange mittens and their camo helmets. They walked through their tree-lined neighborhood on the crisp new morning. The neighborhood piped in holiday music coming from who knows where, handed the family off to the pre-service organ tunes streaming from United Sun God Reformed Blah 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 Church. On top of the church on the corner on a stout metal pole blew a huge Sun God flag that once soared proudly above the car dealership on the highway. It waved in the frosty breeze, rippling perfectly back and forth. A glassed-in bulletin board in the middle of the lawn told the time of services and gave Pastor Steve Cash's saying for the day. The Sun God says, take it to the next level. Save your money. Secure a comfortable retirement. Stay on the same page. The sign on the anteroom bulletin board announced an illegal alien auction next Sunday. Money to go to the summer Bible school mission trip to Branson.
Dick and Jane walked down the middle aisle to their seats in the first row, on the left in front of the lectern. They greeted those around and removed their camo helmets. The kids began watching the tiny TV screens attached to the pews. Dick and Jane sat down, took deep breaths, and smiled, gazing up at the mural covering the wall behind the altar. A tight white T-shirt showed large breasts and the sun god flag with the slogan, "One Nation Under God." The congregation waved, sun god fans. The heat was cranked to full blast. Someone way in back sneaked up and opened just a crack one of the stained glass windows depicting scenes of Jesus slaying the dinosaurs. The organ began to play loud. Congregation rose to sing, then sat, then stood. Pastor Steve approached the lectern. He smiled. He nodded. He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, held it as long as he could, and let it out in a whoosh, spraying those in the front row. 9/11 is on our minds and our hearts. Since 9/11, there can be no more 9/11s. If we recall 9/11, be vigilant about 9/11. Keep it always in our minds, and praise be the sun god. He raised his hands and pressed them down as if pushing on their heads to make them sit. "We're happy for this warm church," she began in a stentorian tremor. "Warming is right and good. The sun god is good and loving and warm. This world must end, should end, will no doubt end at some point, and the righteous, the lovely, the saved will join in sun god paradise forever and ever." "Amen," said the people. "We shall drink and keep drinking, rest and stay sitting, eat and continue eating." He paused and smiled while looking down, then addressed the congregation sternly.
"The evil one has been captured by the forces of rightness and good and warmth. That is good, that is right. We must guard against terrorism and homos, against those who would seek to do us harm, to take away what is rightfully ours, our stuff. It is our stuff. And praise the sun god, we have the bullets and banks and employers and police and courts and jails that will help us to keep it. They will, by God, or they will be out of a job, will be in jail themselves, or such outcasts in their own families and neighborhoods that they will get very depressed, not being able to pay for food or cars or water or electricity, and having no real skills. They will look at the help wanted ads and wonder where in hell they fit in and wish they were dead. So help us, goddammit, amen."
"Amen, goddammit," groaned the sleepy people. Pastor Steve poured himself a glass of ice water from the pitcher on the marble table next to the lectern. He took his time drinking it, sending out individual smiles around the church as he swished and swallowed. He put the glass down, touched his red tie and his white shirt and blue suit with his elegant hands, and became serious again. "Yesterday we celebrated War Day, those who've slaughtered in order that we might be comfortable. It's right and good that we do so, as we do on all our patriotic days. Flag Day, Loyalty Day." He counted each one out on his long reptile fingers. "Veterans Day, Armed Forces Day, Save Your Own Ass First Day, Scattered Guts and Teeth Day, Dripping Layers of Burnt Crisp Brown Skin Day, Squashed Foreign Infant Eyeballs Day." He folded his hands into fists. "It's right and good and warm to have traditions. They tell us who we are, where we're going. They give us steady passage in rough seas, times of trouble. For this, we are thankful. Let us pray."
"And now," said Pastor Steve, "we are proud to bring up someone who is one of us, someone who has served in our military, helping to bring freedom for our bathrooms and vehicles. Please welcome Lance Larson, produce manager at Too Much Food, and staff sergeant in the Mount Liberty National Guard. Dressed in camouflage suit and camo tie and dress shoes, Lance Larson walked from the front row on the right side up to the lectern in front of him, opposite Pastor Steve's podium. He made the sign of the cross up and down and backwards and began talking about how his unit was patrolling, searching for terrorists, insurgents, and people they could kill to secure freedom for America, and as always, trying to find the hidden bookstores.
We went to the door, these suspects, knowing it would make everyone more freer. We pointed our weapons and hollered at the tops of our voices in order to be understood. The women and children had these big, creepy bug eyes. They wouldn't close their effing sorry mouths. We stuck our effing barrels right inside their teeth. We told them to suck it if that's what they wanted. They just kept looking at us like they were scared. All we were saying was to make our friends and family free back home. A friend of mine shot this one kid. Head and hair, blood just sprayed out the back of the kid's head. And I was so proud. Because I knew how free I'd be when I got home to attend the church of my choice.
Pastor Steve balanced by one hand on the podium to switch from his black shoes to his red running shoes. He knelt down to tie one, switched legs to tie the other, and in one leap, pulling his knees to his chest, hopped the communion rail and vaulted by somersaults up the middle aisle. The lieutenant gave the sign and we pulled back out of each other's way and shot the rest of that family, said Lance Larson. The dad and the brothers in back, too, who wouldn't talk, just stared at us. So we shot them first about 100 times. It was good. Felt like we at least did something that night for our country and freedom and church. The Sun God Reformed Church volunteer cheerleaders in the back shook their pom-poms and kicked together and gave the cheer they had been working on every morning that week in the church basement. Hoorah, hoorah, be all you can be. Global force for good. Go Army Strong. That whole little house was full of blood running down the steps, the sidewalk into the street. I shit you negatory, sorry. Saving freedom, that's what I love. That's why I signed up. I do it again. Knowing you people are behind me. The Sun God blesses you. Pastor Steve marched back up the middle aisle in his red tennis shoes, wiping sweat from his forehead. He met Lance Larson and they high-fived. Pastor Steve then turned to the congregation and raised his hands into the air. Now let us exchange greetings with those around us. Dick and Jane and the others high-fived and chest-bumped, while Pastor Steve moved to wait on the altar for the ushers to return with the collection baskets. And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week, same time, same place. We'd like to thank our various sponsors, June2508.com, WorldNewsTrust.com, and TheSpiritualUN.org. And thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.